Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, I have the pleasure today of speaking with Dr. Mrinal Pandey, who is a Berlin-based researcher. We'll be speaking about a fascinating new book that's published as part of Routledge's South Asian Religion series. It's called Popular Hinduism, Stories and Mobile Performances. The subtitle is The Voice of Murari Bapu in Multiple Media. Mrinal, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Dr. Raj, and thank you so much for having me on your podcast. It's going to be a great conversation in the next few moments. Thank you for introducing this book, and it means a lot. And when you ask what is your book about, I guess I would like to introduce the book as saying that the larger focus was to look at the transformation of popular Hinduism. And I began by focusing upon this particular religious cum artistic practice of Ramkatha for the novais, that is the staged narratives of an epic, the Ramcharitmanas, specifically performed by Murari Bapu. So Murari Bapu's Ramkatha was my case study to look at the transformations of popular Hinduism. So this is basically this, the Ramkatha is a traditional storytelling format. And I look at the particular performance, how it engages, ways of participation, how it is produced, and how it is consumed, which is actually, the performance is of an oral text, yeah, and how it relates to experiences. So I consider the implications of a mediated oral practice, that is the katha, which is cultivated not only by the performer, but also by his listeners, you know, and it is staged, could I say spatio-temporally, because it has been staged across transnational spaces, and it has been performed for the last almost five decades. So we look at how, you know, it engages the embodied and sensory elements of everyday living. And specifically, to pinpoint, I have elucidated on the agency of voice here as personified by Murari Bapu. We'll come to it as to why I stress so much upon the voice of Murari Bapu in terms of articulating subjectivity. So this subjectivity is not only a religious subjectivity, but in general about perspectives, feelings, beliefs, desires, and power, importantly. So in short, to summarize, this book engages with voice as a vehicle of meaning to scrutinize its production, dissemination, and reproduction also across mobile contexts.
So tell us a little bit about how you got interested in studying this phenomenon. And also, you could also intersperse this phenomenon, you know, this fairly, I could say relatively new, but certainly prevalent phenomenon of multimedia performance. You know, how did you get interested in studying this?
Okay. I think these are two, three questions together. But to be frank, this is a part of my doctoral thesis. So I hadn't charted out any particular form or design that, you know, I'm going to envisage this project in such a particular manner. And of course, you cannot rule out your subjective experiences. So I have grown up with a very diverse religious background, which had atheists, agnostics all around. And even my own parents followed different schools of thought in that matter. So Ram was something which I was not exposed to all my growing years. And later I traveled to North India after marriage, and I saw the cult of Ram, if I may say, which is so popular in the northern region of India. And well, that kind of triggered some intrigue in me. And also that because he is such a, you know, there's so much of politics with the ideology related to Ram as well. And so it only led to some more curiosity on my end, as well as I was interested in performative arts. And then I happened to hear about Murari Bapu, and a trip to UK was something which brought me even more in contact with persons who were followers of Murari Bapu. And now this was something which was, you know, a coinciding element, and that set the trigger that, okay, I'm going to be looking at Murari Bapu's Ram Katha. And then I took up a course with OCHS as well to understand how one should articulate, because I had a background of history, and then I switched over to anthropology. I looked into performance studies, Natya Shastra, and to understand even the language, yeah, when the followers of Murari Bapu, who call themselves as Shrota, the listeners, and the Satsangis, the ones who are, the direct translation would be companions of truth. So I would just right now here call them as followers, and the kind of language that they used, Satvik Anna, and this Satvik Abhinay, and several, and Rasa, yeah. So they were so much using this performance-based language that all of these elements actually aroused my interest parallelly, and of course all of it was so interestingly woven together in this performance that it would be unfair for me not to look at all these aspects, you know, which came up in the course of looking and participating in this Ram Katha.
You made mention in passing that you had taken an OCHS course, and that's of course the Oxford Center for Hindu Studies.
Yeah,
I have to ask which one. I happened to tutor there. I tutor a few courses there, and I recently created a course on the Devi Mahatmya for the OCHS. Yeah. But I'm curious to know which course.
Understanding Hindu Identity. I think it was
lovely.
Way back in 2010, 2009 or 10 it was. Almost more than
the OCHS has been way ahead of the curve in terms of online education.
Yeah.
Fascinating.
The thing is that I was interested in Indian religion, and more so on the philosophical aspect of religion, you see. But probably certain courses that I had my academic training in were not, you know, correlated to this aspect as well. And so all of this really made the way for this particular study. And I think, yeah, the sensory part, the voice part, all of this was not something which was, you know, planned or thought before, but it just happened in the course of my inquiry.
Well, the Ramakatha, or the story of Rama, the mm-hmm. iterations of the Ramayana,
yeah.
Rich performative tradition. But even if you, I happen to have studied the Valmiki Ramayana from my master's thesis, but mm-hmm. even if you look to just the Sanskrit text, it's so crucial that how is it framed? Rama only recognizes his story by it being performed by his own sons, who are bards. So even the actual framing of the world within the text, it calls us to the performative life of the story of Rama.
Exactly. I guess our epics, and I would say not even Mahabharat, because we know that it was Vyasa who framed the Mahabharat, who wrote the Mahabharat. But here, Valmiki's rendition is just one telling of the Ram Katha, of the Ram story, if I may use the word, because again, Katha kind of puts it into a particular bracket. But as there are so many scholars preceding our work, who have mentioned that there have been more than 300 Ramayanas. So this particular authoritative retelling of the text is something which actually places the text and its author, producer, you know, in a very powerful position. And it's like, how do you say, this particular text has been, you know, being retold and reshaped according to time. And studying this particular retelling also gives us a picture of the socio-political context of that those times. So be it Valmiki, or be it Tulsidas, or be it Ramanand Sagar, or now be it Morari Bapu. So they are all different authors in different times telling us or shape-fitting the stories according to the times.
Yeah, there's a fascinating tension between, you know, the timelessness of the story of Rama, but also the very situated ways in which it's told by individuals and circumstances. So who is this Morari Bapu? Tell us more about him.
Yeah, I like the word situatedness, because I think you would agree with me here that all knowledge is produced from a position. And that is something which is fascinating about knowledge. At the same time, that is the reason why scholars and intellectuals are always at loggerheads also, because then there are rightist positions, there are leftist positions. And yeah, so coming back to the situatedness, so it's a particular positioning. So Morari Bapu's position towards the Ram Katha is also what is what makes him interesting. So, well, you asked me about Morari Bapu.
Who is, just contextualize for a broader audience, who is this figure?
Yeah, so Morari Bapu is an Indian spiritual leader and also a preacher from Gujarat, West India. Yeah, he's popularly known as the Kathakar for his discourses on Ram Katha. He has narrated the Gopi Geet and all, but precisely mainly for this Ram Katha. And he has, in this process, you know, he has gathered a sizable amount of followers, not only in India, but beyond. It is said about him that, to give a background of him, it's said that his grandfather taught him the Chaupai or the quatrain, you know, poetry that has a meter of 4 syllables. So he held his first discourse when he was about 14 years of age, you know. So, and since then there has been no going back. So that kind of explains his expertise, that he's been performing these kathas since so early on. It's a part of his habitus. So he, I think till this October 2022, he has performed over 900 Ram kathas already. Each of these are 9 days based upon the reading of the Ramcharitmanas. And they are typically accompanied with bhajan and this bhojan prasad rituals. And he gives these discourses mainly in Gujarati as well as in Hindi. Now, different places have been selected and appropriated as venues for this Ram Katha. So from traditional temples and streets, his performances have, you know, been conducted in schools, playgrounds, auditoriums, air-conditioned halls. So you must be wondering, why is she telling me these details? But these details are even more important because he's performed in a jumbo jet, in submarines, on mountains, in violence-afflicted settings. So this mobility of Morari Bapu's Ram Katha, you know, from these pilgrim centers and exhibition halls and cruise ships, this exhibits the his followers and his patrons, or sponsors, as you can call them. It exhibits their interests and their aspirations as well. Mind you, the performances have traveled to many cities of India, as well as countries like Australia, Brazil, Canada, Israel, Indonesia, Japan, Kenya, United States, United Kingdom, Rome, South Africa, Kenya, Uganda, you name it, and he's kind of performed in major cities. When he's traveling and performing, not everybody, of course, can go afford to go or be there. So he addresses his shrotas through the medium of Ramkatha, and his diverse audiences include the live audiences as well as the technologically mediated audiences. And then it's not that he's just reading the book, you know, he at times, or rather off late, he's been just picking up a particular verse or a particular character. So he recites the Ramcharitmanas effortlessly, then shares stories and anecdotes with his listeners, who address their questions or doubts to him. No? So a stark example of cultural specificity, you know, to a performance staged amid authentic and historical modes of presentation. The audiences are taken by awe, and they are subject to experiencing altered emotional states. So that's the reason why his Ramkathas are, you know, still popular over the last five decades.
So why do you emphasize his voice so much? What is it about the voice?
Yeah, well, it's not a part of my
I think
voice.
It's, I have to make a meta comment that we're asking this question in the medium of podcast, where all they have is their voice. But anyhow.
Exactly. So now that you gave me another thread to begin with, see, the thing is that one needs to understand sometimes the historicity of a particular performance. The thing is that he began around the 1980s. To be precise, 1975 or 76, he had already performed in Nairobi. So you can see that his name had been spreading already, his fame rather. And during those times, what people had access to was audio cassettes. Yeah. So it so happened, like I'm just telling you a story which was told to me, that a group of families would invite him to their tiny flats or houses from Gujarat to Bombay or somewhere in Ahmedabad, which is the capital city of Gujarat. And he would be performing there, and people would be recording his voice on the cassette. Okay. Of course, the message is important, but the message is trapped in the voice, mind you. Yeah. And then these cassettes were passed over amongst the family networks and ties, yeah, social networks. And then these social networks extended beyond India. And when people outside India heard his voice, and, you know, they're already nostalgic, you know, that the story of Ramayana, as Bhikkhu Parekh and Chetan Bhatt, both of them have said that this is a classic text of exile and displacement that Indians really identify with, you know, the suffering. Of course, there is no comparison to the old diaspora, you know, the indentured part of our history. So they really had this suffering. But this generation, the new diaspora, also had the longing to come back. In the 1980s and 90s, a longing not for permanent coming back, but just to meet their loved ones, you know, and especially the housewives who were alone in the homes of US and UK. And then his voice was something which really caught on like fire. And they circulated these cassettes, and everybody went on asking, who is this person? Who is this person? Many of them had heard his voice, had several cassettes of him, and had no idea of the name of the person. Or even they wouldn't have recognized him had they seen him across. So so you see how now voice has been built over a period of time. And then, of course, there were other performers. There's no denying the fact that there have been other Ramkatha performers in India, as well as those traveling outside India. But yet, Murari Bapu's voice was something which had already caught on the psyche of so many of them. And especially because of this cassette. And that's why I say that it is this particular voice of Murari Bapu, which, you know, became a vehicle of meaning. And also, it's a kind of an authority. See, the thing is that Murari Bapu comes not from a Brahmin family, but still he has this authoritative telling of the Ramkatha. And if I use the word authoritative retelling, so who's given him this authority? Of course, his audiences who want to listen to him, who decide that he is really well versed with the scriptures. Yeah. So that's how his voice was something which came up recurrently. And then I sewed it into my data with regards to Hindu traditions and sound and, you know, all of those things.
Mm. How is your book structured?
Okay. So yet again, yeah, that's a very interesting question, actually, because as usual, the first part is the introduction where I give a theoretical background of the concepts that I'm going to be using. And, you know, I began by looking, as I mentioned previously, that I love this whole performance arts. So I had the idea of performance studies, and I looked at the Ram Katha as a performance. So that was my first part of the book. And my performances took me further to sound and voice. So then sound happened to be one chapter. His voice created, you know, a whole set of feelings which people described in different forms, what they experienced, not only altered emotional states triggered by his voice, but triggered by several other sensory elements such as foods, smells, touch. Yeah, so then sensory chapter happened. And then, of course, you know, when you are trained in academia, there is nothing that is not political. So I had to look, I did ask people, of course, they said, oh, no, you're attending a spiritual performance, but there is nothing that is not political. So, of course, I had to look at the particular political part, and I titled that particular aspect as the construction of a Hindu voice. And when I finally sat to write the book, I realized that, oh, you know, something that all of these things have something of the place element into it. And I would say that places as a chapter just happened when I started writing the book. And that is one of the best parts of this book, which has been written in the process of the book without any plans to it. So, yeah, that's how impromptu it has been.
So then what sorts of interests or subfields does this book pertain to? Who might most be interested in this book in terms of fields of study or interests?
Okay. I would say that firstly, people who are already plugged into these spiritual discourses in India could do fine with this reading. And you see, he has a local as well as global following, you know. So from ordinary village folk to middle classes to industrialists in India, outside India as well. So all of these people could read this book because it's written in as simple language as possible. Secondly, also to scholars of South Asia, because I think that I have tried to cover much of our religious discourses. And of course, when lecturers and students at universities, you know, pinpointedly universities, like the academia can definitely use a few chapters if one is looking at the spatial dynamics of religion, or the sensory part, or the sound, because I think there is still some limited material when it comes to sound in Hinduism. There are immense works.
Performance theory, performance in religion.
But graduate students probably would find it easier to, you know, go through this book for sure, rather than delving into very heavy theoretical stuff, because this is like what I saw and I have written down that time. So, yeah.
Excellent. Well, was there anything else about the book you wanted to touch on today? Seems we probably covered most of the food groups.
Yeah, about the book. What makes him even more popular is, I would say that, you know, the thing is that he has a very innovative way of looking at things, and he is also accommodative in terms of the changes in the society, and for that he has been criticized, taken to task, But the interesting part is that since he has a story which has multiple variants with no clear ending, you know, you are an efficient designer, and then you can sew the fabric just the way it is for that particular moment, you know. So he can sew it up so contextually with his interpretation.
That's the power of the bard. That's exactly, the dharma of the bard. Exactly. That's the missing Pauranika, the storyteller who has to adapt it to the moment.
He effortlessly alternates between historical facts, mythological stories, and an embodied imaginary, you know, making him a literal subject as well as a powerful narrator. So exactly what Valmiki also does, the author appears in the story as well as is writing the story. So that's what exactly he is. And I don't think that this caliber can be achieved so easily by somebody, you know, even if a person could be formally trained in performance studies, I would say that would be a very difficult task.
There's a skill, there's an ability there that's been polished. Yeah.
And the evocation of audience responses is infinitely nuanced, you know. It becomes a means towards the larger social, religious, political ends. So every time they are revisiting the text, the text is Ramcharitmanas. Yeah, so one would say, okay, if the text is unique, it hasn't to be repeated. But these performances are continuously being repeated. Yeah, but yet not.
There's an
ongoing repetition, but never the same. So that is what is something which is really, really enchanting.
If they it's say enchanting.
Yes, that is the exact.
It's the life of tradition. It's the life of the text.
Yes.
So many times I say to folks, Puranas and even the epics, they're like sheet music. They need to be brought to life in a certain context.
I like that metaphor.
Well, thank you very much for appearing on the podcast today.
Thank you so much, Dr. Raj. Thank you for calling me, and I enjoyed it as well. Thank you.
For those of you listening, we've been talking about a brand new book in the Routledge South Asian Religion series called Popular Hinduism Stories and Mobile Performances. Until next time, stay well. Keep listening and keep contemplating the power of performance. Take care.